For this May 11th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Tuesday headlines. In what is the latest sign of how production problems are hurting the distribution of the single-dose shot from Johnson & Johnson, more of the vaccine will not be available until next week at the earliest. This update from a White House call to some of the nation's governors indicating that a new supply of the J&J shot is not immediately available for ordering. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing that rules requiring all lawmakers and staff to wear masks on the House floor will be relaxed slightly. Members of Congress can now remove them while recognized to speak during debate. The speaker indicating the change is in accordance with updated guidance from the Capitol's attending physician. Meanwhile, the Senate taking up a contentious debate over the nation's election laws with some sharp words today in the Senate Rules Committee. In the Middle East, another round of fighting and airstrikes between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers, as well as between Jewish residents, Israeli police, and Arab citizens. The Washington Post describing it this way, the violence is a day of upheaval in Jerusalem, leading to more than two dozen deaths. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We want to begin with some of the latest developments on COVID-19. Kids as young as 12 years old soon will be able to get the Pfizer vaccine here in the U.S., marking another milestone in what medical experts are describing as the country's already record-breaking vaccination campaign. The FDA expanding emergency use authorization for that Pfizer shot to include young teenagers. That came yesterday. States will be given the go-ahead to administer the shot to the new age group as soon as the CDC gives its approval. That could come as early as tomorrow. Dr. Rochelle Walensky heads up the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She testified earlier today before the Senate Health Committee.
I want to close with a promise and an appeal to the American people. My promise is that CDC will continue to follow the science as our guide. And my appeal is to implore everyone to get a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as possible as the fastest way to end this pandemic. But even with this powerful tool, while we continue to have community transmission, we must also maintain public health measures we know will prevent the spread of this virus: mask, hygiene, hand hygiene, and physical distancing. Finally, as we get through this pandemic, we must work together over the months and years ahead to build on the investments, partnerships, and innovations that we have created during this crisis. This includes achieving sustainable investments in public health infrastructure to be better prepared for whatever comes next. It is one way we can turn tragedy into lasting progress and improved health for all.
And Dr. Walensky is the CDC director on Capitol Hill. And during that same hearing, Dr. Anthony Fauci had another often testy exchange with Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, this time over the origins of COVID-19. The Kentucky Republican is alleging that NIH had been sending funding to that Wuhan lab in China, which then juiced up, in his words, a virus that was originally found in bats to create a supervirus that would infect human cells. Here's how that exchange unfolded.
Dr. Fauci, we don't know whether the pandemic started in a lab in Wuhan or evolved naturally, but we should want to know. 3 million people have died from this pandemic, and that should cause us to explore all possibilities. Instead, government authorities, self-interested in continuing gain-of-function research, say there's nothing to see here. Gain-of-function research, as you know, is juicing up naturally occurring animal viruses to infect humans. To arrive at the truth, the U.S. government should admit that the Wuhan Virology Institute was experimenting to enhance the coronavirus's ability to infect humans. Juicing up superviruses is not new. Scientists in the U.S. have long known how to mutate animal viruses to infect humans. For years, Dr. Ralph Barrick, a virologist in the U.S., has been collaborating with Dr. Shi Zhengli of the Wuhan Virology Institute, sharing his discoveries about how to create superviruses. This gain-of-function research has been funded by the NIH. The collaboration between the U.S. and the Wuhan Virology Institute continues. Doctors Barrick and Shi worked together to insert bat virus spike protein into the backbone of the deadly SARS virus, and then use this man-made supervirus to infect human airway cells. Think about that for a moment. The SARS virus had a 15% mortality. We're fighting a pandemic that has about a 1% mortality. Can you imagine if a SARS virus that's been juiced up and had viral proteins added to it, to the spike protein, if that were released accidentally? Dr. Fauci, do you still support funding of the NIH funding of the lab in Wuhan?
Senator Paul, with all due respect, you are entirely and completely incorrect that the NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of
Virology. Do they fund
Dr.
Barrick?
We do not fund.
Do you fund Dr. Barrick's gain-of-function research?
Dr. Barrick does not doing gain-of-function research, and if it is, it's according to the guidelines, and it is being conducted in North Carolina, not
You don't think
in
inserting
China.
A bat virus spike protein that he got from the Wuhan Institute into the SARS virus is gain-of-function?
That is not.
You would not be in the minority because at least 200 scientists have signed a statement from the Cambridge Working Group saying that it is gain-of-function.
Well, it is not. And if you look at the grant and you look at the progress reports, it is not gain of function, despite the fact that people tweet that.
So do you still support sending money to the Wuhan Virology Institute?
We do not send money now to the Wuhan Virology Institute.
Do you support sending money? We did, under your tutelage. We were sending it through EcoHealth. It was a sub-agency and a sub-grant.
That from today's hearing, TheHill.com has more background on this exchange. Quote, NIH gave a grant to a group called EcoHealth Alliance, which hired the virology lab in Wuhan, China, to conduct genetic analysis of bat coronavirus and examine how they spread to humans. We should point out the Trump administration last year forcing NIH to terminate that grant. Hill.com goes on to write the following. The false link between Dr. Fauci, NIH, and the Wuhan lab had been circulating among right-wing media and politicians like Senator Paul and Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin for months. More details at thehill.com. Meanwhile, President Biden held a virtual meeting with governors from Ohio, Utah, Massachusetts, Maine, Minnesota, and New Mexico as the administration moving ahead towards its goal of getting 70% of adults at least partially vaccinated by July 4th. More than half of the residents in Massachusetts, Maine, and New Mexico, they've already had at least one shot, ranking those states in the top 10. Ohio and Utah, they're in the bottom half of the states for the vaccination rates. More with President Biden.
But the point is that we know we want to get something done. It's all about governors and mayors and county executives, all local. It's on the street. And to meet the goal that I set last week, we need to accomplish three things, in my view. One, we have to make it easier and more convenient for all Americans to get vaccinated. And you're busting your neck doing that. Two, to build confidence in vaccines by delivering facts and answer questions to anyone who might have one and have thorough answers. And three, by ensuring that we reach everyone with an equitable response that as we enter this next phase. And to help us get there, we've added two new tools. One, Americans can go to vaccines.gov. Or they can text their zip code to their zip code, text it to 438829. Let me say it again, 438829. And they'll get at least three locations near them with vaccines in stock at that moment. And in my direction, more than 20,000 pharmacies coast to coast are now offering walk-in vaccinations by no appointment necessary. And the governors are, you all are stepping up to increase the availability of walk-in vaccinations as well. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is shifting focus from larger vaccination sites to smaller community-based sites and mobile clinics to reach more people where they are. And we've recently made significant new investments around vaccine education, including funds to help states and community organizations get the word out on the local level. Just yesterday, the Food and Drug Administration expanded the emergency use authorization for the Pfizer vaccine for children 12 to 15 years of age. 12 to 15. that more parents, that means parents who want to protect their children, younger teens who want to get vaccinated, we're a step closer to that goal now.
From the White House earlier today with President Biden, and joining us on the phone from Maryland is Dr. Lena Wen. She is an emergency physician, a CNN contributor, and a columnist for The Washington Post. Let me begin with what seems to be a disparity between what some states are doing and others not achieving in terms of the vaccine rollout. What's going on out there?
Well, we always knew that this was going to be the hardest part of the vaccine distribution. Initially, it was, we build it and they will come. The people who came to get vaccinated were the people who were so eager to get vaccinated. Well, now is the hard part. The rates of the willing in different states is certainly different. And so part of that is the underlying attitudes of individuals across the country. Another is the infrastructure that's needed in order to reach people who are on the fence about getting vaccinated, to do active outreach, and also to make vaccination the easy and convenient choice. There are absolutely still Americans who want to be vaccinated, but who are just so busy. They are not thinking about COVID-19 every day. They're working multiple jobs. They are taking care of young children, elderly parents, and we have to make vaccination the easy choice for them by setting up new infrastructure, mobile vans, bringing vaccines to schools, to churches, to workplaces. That takes time. That takes resources. And I really hope that governors and mayors across the country are looking at this next phase saying, what more do we need to do to increase vaccination rates? Because vaccination is, at this point, our only way out of the pandemic.
And as you know, there are a number of concerns by individuals. First, if I get the vaccine, I'm going to suffer from the virus. Secondly, when Johnson & Johnson paused its vaccine for 10 days, giving Americans a chance to say, do I want to get the vaccine? To those two concerns, what do you tell those individuals?
Well, the first thing is you're not going to get coronavirus from the coronavirus vaccine. This does not contain a live virus, and so that's not possible. And actually, it's quite the opposite. We know that there have been over 570,000 people in the U.S. who have died from COVID-19. Many others are suffering long-term consequences as a result of this. And the best way you can prevent this from happening to you and to people that you love is to be vaccinated. The second concern about the rare blood clotting disorder for Johnson & Johnson, I think we could say for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, well over 100 million people have received those vaccines without this clotting disorder. Those vaccines don't have this concern. With Johnson & Johnson, if you are in the age group of being a woman between the ages of 18 and 50, then you should consider taking the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine instead of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But if you're not in this age group, the risk to you is extremely low. And I think we should take away from all of this that even for something that is as rare as potentially close to 1 in a million, the FDA and CDC, our federal health officials, caught that potential risk. And so that is how carefully they are scrutinizing these vaccines and prioritizing safety.
We're talking with Dr. Lena Wen. She is a public health expert and an emergency room physician. News about the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for those between the ages of 12 to 15 years old. What should parents do?
Well, I'm really excited and relieved about this news because we want for our children to also have the benefit of the vaccines that adults do. I think there are a lot of families that are in this mixed vaccination household where parents are vaccinated, but younger children are not. And I think it'll be a great relief for parents and teens to be able to receive this vaccine. So we expect that later this week, the CDC is going to be approving FDA authorization of the 12 to 15-year-old category. I would expect that many places are going to start extending the Pfizer vaccine to this age range. Not every place is going to, and so I think if parents are certain and the teens are certain that they want to be vaccinated, they should start calling around now to find out which are the places that will be offering to this age range. It's only the Pfizer vaccine, and some places may not administer the vaccine to this younger age group because of the training of the people there, and so it's important to find out. I think it's also now is the time to have the conversation with your adolescents to see what it is that they want. Many teens are so eager to have sleepovers and birthday parties and to go shopping with their friends and travel and other things again and not be a risk to themselves or others. And so I think it really is, this comes at a really good time and I think will bring us all that much closer to ending the pandemic.
Well, Dr. Nguyen, to that point, as you look ahead to the summer travel and camping season, and then into the fall as students head back to the classroom, both elementary, secondary, and the college level, how is this all going to unfold? What's your projection?
I think that we have reached an important turning point in the pandemic. I think at this point, we are going to see a steady decline and then actually a very rapid decline in the number of COVID-19 cases as we have warmer weather and people are going outdoors, as vaccination rates continue to tick up. I think we're going to follow the path of Israel that went from having more than 10,000 new COVID-19 cases a day to well under 100. I think this is coming our way. I think we're going to have a great summer ahead. That's the great news. And of course, the great news is our kids are going to be back in school. People are going to be back at work. Things are going to look very normal coming into the fall. The downside, though, is that I think the people who are on the fence about getting vaccinated, many of them will see even less reason to get vaccinated because if they already don't think that COVID is a threat, they're going to feel even less like it's a threat come the fall when restrictions are essentially all lifted. My concern is that the communities that don't come anywhere close to having the majority of people vaccinated could become hot spots again in the winter. And especially if we have variants arising in other countries, we could be in for another tough time this winter. And the best way for us to prevent that, I feel like I sound like a broken record, but the best way for us to prevent that is by increasing our rates of vaccination right now. We should not rest, even if the summer looks like it's a much better time for us.
And before we let you go, your new book coming out later this year, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. The message in the book is what?
The message in the book is that public health saved your life today. Now we're beginning to know it. Now we're beginning to see what happens when there isn't that kind of sustained investment in public health. But on the other hand, there are things that we can do. And in the book, I talk a lot about the work that we did when I was the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, in particular about the work that communities across the country are doing to improve health and reduce disparities.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, who also serves as a visiting professor of health policy and management at George Washington University. She's also a columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Meanwhile, the situation in India is becoming more dire this evening. The New York Times writing the following, quote, "The desperation that engulfed New Delhi, India's capital, over the past few weeks is now spreading across the entire country, hitting states and rural areas with many fewer resources. Positivity rates are soaring in those states, and public health experts say that the rising numbers most likely will fall far short of giving the true picture in places where sickness and deaths caused by COVID-19 are harder to track." You can get more details at nytimes.com. And according to Johns Hopkins University, the death toll in India so far as a result of COVID-19 has exceeded 250,000. On Capitol Hill, it was a debate over election and voting laws that took center stage before the Senate Rules Committee. Lawmakers discussing and debating some significant changes proposed by Democrats, Republicans calling it a federal takeover of the voting process. Now, the bill comes as a number of Republican-led states, including Florida and Georgia, proposing and enacting laws to rein in ballot box access. Democrats trying to use their narrow congressional majorities to step in. Just underscoring how important it is to the Democratic Party, they have reserved the first legislative slot in the Senate as S1, and in the House it's HR1 for the legislation known as, quote, For the People Act. Here's Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
The bill before this committee has a very simple premise: make it easier, not harder, to vote. S1 would nullify many of these voter suppression laws and protect the rights of American voters, whether they cast their ballots for Democrats or Republicans. It would automatically register American voters when they get a driver's license, guarantee at least 15 continuous days of early voting, end partisan gerrymandering, and bring transparency to our campaign finance system. I know my Republican colleagues don't like every aspect of it. Fine. Tell us how you change it. Offer good faith amendments to improve the bill, which the chair has said she would graciously and eagerly entertain. But, my Republican colleagues, if you choose the path of uncompromising opposition, you will cast yourself in league with the most reprehensible, sweeping, voter suppression effort in decades. That is a legacy-defining choice. I yield the floor.
That with Senator Chuck Schumer earlier today, Republicans putting forth more than 180 amendments that would weaken or even sink the Democratic plan. Among the most vocal critics, Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
You know, I listened to the speeches this morning. I listened to Senator Schumer's speech, where he recounted this country's shameful history of Jim Crow laws. And he's right. Jim Crow laws were bigoted, racist, and disenfranchised millions of people. And it is worth remembering that those Jim Crow laws were drafted by Democrats, they were implemented by Democrats, and they kept Democrats in power. Now, today's talking point repeated in the media is that was the Democrats of yesterday, not today. Well, today the Democrats are doing it again. This legislation, to use a phrase that has been popularized on the media recently, is Jim Crow 2.0. This legislation would disenfranchise millions of Americans. Many of us are referring to this legislation as the Corrupt Politicians Act, because it would do. Senator Schumer talked about politicians picking their constituents. That's what this legislation does. This legislation is designed to ensure that Democrats never lose another election. This legislation would register millions of illegal aliens to vote. It is intended to do that. It is intended to do that because Democrats have made the decision that millions of illegal aliens voting are likely to vote for Democrats. This would register vast numbers of criminals and felons to vote because Democrats have made the decisions that criminals and felons are likely to vote for Democrats. This legislation strikes down virtually every voter integrity law adopted at the state level. Voter ID laws. Over 70% of Americans support voter ID laws. By the way, over 60% of African Americans in this country support voter ID laws. 29 states have voter ID laws on the books. What does this legislation do? Strikes them all down.
From today's Senate Rules Committee, and that with Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Earlier today, TheHill.com had this headline: the Senate poised for an all-day brawl over a sweeping elections bill. Joining us on Capitol Hill is Jordan Carney. She's been following this story. How did the day unfold?
So the Rules Committee spent hours prepping and debating amendments to S1, the For the People Act. There were almost 180 amendments that were filed. Republicans, you know, not able to stop this bill necessarily in committee, really put their focus on, you know, efforts to delay it, trying to highlight the parts of the bill that they view most problematic. McConnell has said, you know, it's his top priority to try to stop this bill. But Democrats sort of made the arguments that I think you've been hearing them make, that this bill is needed given some of the sort of the state voting laws that are being debated and enacted, and really drove home the message that in order to sort of bolster our democracy, they need to pass this bill.
But we heard from a number of Senate Republicans, including Roy Blunt of Missouri, calling this a one-size-fits-all approach. How do Democrats respond to that?
Yeah, so the line from Republicans is that this is, you know, a federal takeover of the elections. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, you know, made an appearance at this hearing, and even though he's a member of the panel, that's still pretty rare, and really called this bill, you know, like a defining moment for Republicans. And they, you know, made the argument to them that they need to decide if they are going to support expanding and maybe strengthening access to the ability to vote, as you see Republicans across the country, you know, talking about maybe restricting access. He tied it to this, you know, kind of separate debate that Republicans are having over the 2020 election, Liz Cheney, and trying to sort of paint this broader narrative of Republicans being at a crossroads of their party.
Well, let me pick up on that point, because as you point out in your piece at TheHill.com, Republican-led states around the country are proposing laws that, in essence, would rein in some of the ballot access issues. So what's happening in the states compared to what we're seeing unfold here in Washington?
So, I mean, they were talking about, like, the Georgia law that was enacted. I mean, it's really been their focal point Senator Ossoff, who's, you know, the Democratic senator from Georgia, actually offered an amendment during the Rules Committee markup about offering sort of like food and water to voters in line in a direct response to that. And, I mean, Democrats view, in some cases, laws that have not actually been enacted in states but have been, you know, proposed, let's say, in states as a clear sign that some sort of federal action is needed.
So what happens next? What's the timeline in the Senate?
So because the Rules Committee is actually evenly split, 9-9 Republicans and Democrats, this bill cannot pass out of committee. It's going to, you know, there is going to be a tie. So they're going to have to make a decision after this committee vote about how they move forward. They have a few options. You know, they could try to discharge it onto the floor. They could, you know, make it a substitute amendment to another bill and file cloture. They could Rule 14 it, try to get it on the calendar. But Schumer has been very clear that he's going to bring this bill up for a vote. He has suggested that the timeline for trying to pass this in the Senate is sort of before August, so before the August recess. The problem, of course, is, you know, the legislative filibuster. There will not be 60 votes for this bill. No Republican is a co-sponsor. And even further than that, it doesn't actually unify all 50 Democrats. So they've got some discussions to have as a caucus.
And among those Democrats, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, correct?
So Manchin has been the most vocal about the For the People, the Act, and arguing that, you know, anything that Congress does on elections needs to be bipartisan. He has suggested focusing much more on the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, but on the filibuster, both he and Sinema are pretty on the record saying they won't change the filibuster.
A story that will continue to unfold, the reporting of Jordan Carney. She's on Capitol Hill this Tuesday. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
On Wall Street, it was a day of some big sell-offs. The Dow losing 473 points, marking its worst day since February. The S&P was down 36. The NASDAQ was off 12.5. And a former president of the UAW, the United Auto Workers, who took part in a scheme along with other union officials in which they collectively embezzled at least $1.5 million in member funds, money used for golfing vacations, expensive dinners, and other luxuries, today sentenced to 21 months in prison. Dennis Williams is so far the highest-ranking official to be sentenced, part of a multi-year criminal investigation into the labor union. He is one of 15 people to have been charged, including three Fiat Chrysler executives. Dennis Williams pleading guilty back in September to conspiring with other union officials to embezzle hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was part of a plea deal with federal prosecutors. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Tuesday. A U.S. judge dismissing the National Rifle Association's bankruptcy case, ruling that the organization cannot use the bankruptcy code to relocate from New York to Texas, which is viewed by the NRA as a more gun-friendly state. So with this decision, the NRA group will remain incorporated in New York. It did file for bankruptcy back in January. And on Capitol Hill, Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Sasse saying that he will be introducing legislation this week to grant signing bonuses to new hires. Now, these bonuses would replace expanded unemployment benefits aimed at boosting employment. Senator Sasse calling the numbers on the latest jobs report, quote, crummy, when the U.S. gained only about 266,000 jobs in April, missing the forecast that was much higher, expected to be closer to 1 million new jobs. That, by the way, was the biggest miss in decades. The violence is continuing for a fourth day in Jerusalem. Hamas has launched a rocket attack towards Tel Aviv after an Israeli airstrike destroyed an office tower in Gaza. The Jerusalem Post is reporting this evening that a woman was killed and a person was critically wounded following a barrage of rockets in the direction of Tel Aviv late into the night, setting off sirens throughout the center of the country. And the Washington Post writing the following, quote, a day of upheaval at the holy sites of this contested city quickly widening into a night of warlike violence in communities across Israel today, with hundreds of rockets from the Gaza Strip resulting in the death of at least two Israelis and airstrikes killing at least 26 along the Gaza Strip. So at the White House today, Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about these latest acts of violence in the region.
Final item for all of you on the situation in Jerusalem and Gaza. The president has been briefed daily on developments in Jerusalem and Gaza. He just received another update before I came out here from the National Security Advisor. Since last week, he has directed his team to engage intensively with senior Israeli and Palestinian officials, as well as leaders throughout the Middle East. His team is communicating a clear and consistent message in support of de-escalation, and that is our primary focus. The president's support for Israel's security, for its legitimate right to defend itself, and its people is fundamental and will never waver. We condemn ongoing rocket attacks by Hamas and other terrorist groups, including against Jerusalem. We also stand against extremism that has inflicted violence on both communities. Jerusalem, a city of such importance to people of faith around the world, must be a place of coexistence. It is up to the officials, residents, and leaders to restore the city to a place of calm. The president and his team will continue to pursue the conditions for diplomacy, dialogue, and de-escalation, and protection of civilians, even as we work together with our friends to deter acts of violence and terrorism. We will also continue to support a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That is the only way to ensure the just and lasting peace that two peoples have struggled to achieve. We believe Palestinians and Israelis deserve equal measures of freedom, security, dignity, and prosperity. And U.S. officials in recent weeks have spoken candidly with Israeli officials about how evictions of Palestinian families who have lived for years, sometimes decades, in their homes and of demolitions of these homes work against our common interests in achieving a solution to the conflict. In the coming days, as Muslims gather with family and friends to celebrate Eid, and Jews join together to mark the beginning of Shabbat, let us affirm that all people of faith deserve to enjoy these important celebrations without fear of violence and work toward peace and calm.
From today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Meanwhile, a debate over gun laws before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the U.S. Constitution. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro testifying about his efforts to try to close legal loopholes in the Keystone State that would stop, among other things, the sale of what are called ghost guns. Those, of course, are firearms that can be built from a kit ordered off the web, but the gun does not require any ID, licensing, or background checks in order to purchase. Here's Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal. He chairs the subcommittee.
Do ghost guns impede your ability to go after gun traffickers?
Not at all, Mr. Chairman. We can walk and chew gum at the same time in Pennsylvania, and we do just that. We have special units in my office dedicated to gun trafficking. I formed a special alliance, for example, with New Jersey Attorney General Gurbir Graywall, and we launched an initiative to focus on gun trafficking between predominantly Camden and Philadelphia, where we recently had an operation, Operation Zombie, which netted us more than 26 guns and shut down a gun trafficking ring there as well. We can do both. We're also finding that gun traffickers are trafficking in these ghost guns. And remember, typically, if you're a criminal and you are in need of getting a gun, you either need to rely on a gun trafficking network or rely on a straw purchaser to go in for you. Utilizing these ghost guns, which do not require a background check, you take the straw and the gun trafficker out of that equation, and the criminal can now buy the gun directly. So we can do all of the above, but we can't ignore ghost guns, which are a massive threat in our communities today.
You showed us the jig, which is, in a sense, the container that is used to make the frame. By drilling holes that are pre-marked, would you say there is any particular artistry or craftsmanship involved in making one of these frames using a pre-made kit of this kind?
No artistry, no craftsmanship, and, Senator, very little skill is required. Let me tell you how it really works. You go to the gun show, you go over to table A, and you buy this. You then go over to table B, you get the other parts. And by the way, table B is this far away. And as I talked about in the example of the York County gun show, they'll assemble it for you right there. In fact, they had a criminal who was a white supremacist doing the work for you right there. So either they can do it for you there, or you could take it home, as was the example I used from Philadelphia, where they were buying them by the duffel bag load and assembling them there and then selling them for more than a 100% profit on the streets. I could have one of these put together within 20 minutes, and, Senator, as my wife and kids will tell you, I'm not particularly handy. So if I can do it in 20, someone who's handy can do it in even less.
And that from Josh Shapiro. He is the Pennsylvania Attorney General testifying here in Washington before a Senate subcommittee. Also from the Senate hearing, Republican Mike Lee of Utah. He questioned Richard Vasquez. He is formerly with ATF, that, of course, the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives. He now works as a consultant for the firearms industry.
There are a number of people, including you, who have raised concerns that this proposed rule could be the beginning of a national firearm registry. Could you explain why?
Yes, sir, and thank you for that question. And I'd like to expand on that somewhat. One of the things said earlier was that citizens were required to serialize firearms since the beginning of the Gun Control Act, and that's incorrect. 923I under the Gun Control Act specifies that only licensed manufacturers and licensed importers are required to put a serial number on them so that an individual could still manufacture or build his own firearm without having to put required markings on it. And as far as turning this into a registration, I know the burdens that has already been put on gunsmiths. There's a fine line between what is a gunsmith and what is a manufacturer. And the proposal was to have ATF proposed was to give gunsmiths the ability to put serial numbers on homemade firearms for people who wanted to make their homemade firearm. And then they would mark these with a portion of their license and an annotated serial number. I could see in a very short period of time where ATF or Department of Justice would be contacting these gun dealers by their license number and asking them to produce the amount of firearms that they serialize for individuals on a daily or weekly basis. And then it comes, and like I said, when it comes to the point is, if I make my own firearm, I'm not required to serialize it. So why should I put a serial number and give it up to somebody else and have them put it in some type of registry? And that's what it becomes.
Now, to be clear, most firearms that are used to commit crimes are obtained illegally in order to circumvent the next background check system. So in many cases, they're stolen or they're bought by straw purchasers or they're purchased on the black market. All of these things are illegal under current law. Now, in light of this, how will serializing 80% lowers and requiring a NICS check on law-abiding Americans who purchase them, how will that make us safer?
Senator Lee, that is a great comment. Because criminals do not fill out 4473s today, and they do not do NICS checks. So they will continually look for a loophole to find an illegal firearm. They are not buying firearms the way you or I would, and there will never be a shortage of firearms for criminals. As I said, I've traveled all over Central America and Mexico on behalf of ATF, and there was no shortage of foreign-made firearms. When they run out of firearms that they can attain in the United States, they will find other markets. Then it'll really get bad when they start bringing in these military-grade firearms made in China, Russia, Yugoslavia, and other countries, because criminals will always get the firearms they need to run their cartel organization.
And that from Richard Vasquez. As you heard, he's formerly with ATF. He now serves as a consultant to the firearms industry and Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Meanwhile, gas stations along the East Coast beginning to run out of fuel as North America's biggest petroleum pipeline works to recover from that cyber attack that kept it shut down for days. From Virginia and the Carolinas to Florida and Alabama, stations tonight reporting that they have sold out of gasoline as supplies in the region begin to dwindle and panic buying is now setting in. The White House, in a statement, says it is monitoring the situation, directing government agencies to help alleviate any shortages. Colonial Pipeline saying it is manually operating a segment of the pipeline running from North Carolina to Maryland, expecting to substantially restore all service by this weekend. Now, that pipeline has been shut down since late Friday. Meanwhile, the company still has not shared important technical information with the Department of Homeland Security's cyber agency about that ransomware attack that crippled its fuel supply operations. Brandon Wales heads up the agency within DHS. He testified today before the Senate Homeland Security Committee. We begin with this line of questioning from Michigan Senator Gary Peters.
Mr. Wales, I know we're here today to focus on federal cybersecurity, but I think it's important to discuss the attack that we have just recently seen on Colonial Pipeline, one of the largest attacks on critical infrastructure in our history. Last month, Ranking Member Portman and I introduced the Cyber Response and Recovery Act, which would give the Secretary of Homeland Security the authority to declare a significant incident and use cyber response and recovery fund after events like this. I know you're familiar with the legislation that we've introduced. And while I understand it's too soon for this to talk about this in relation to this specific situation, we're still learning a lot about that, and we'll see the impact of that in the days and weeks ahead. But if you could answer the question is, how would this new authority enable CISA to provide more assistance during these types of incidents? And whether they occur on privately owned critical infrastructure or the federal systems. What's your assessment?
Sure, sir. And again, we think that this is an absolutely instrumental advancement in the country's ability to respond to significant and catastrophic cyber incidents. We have seen that our adversaries are increasingly focused on broad, significant campaigns. Campaigns that do not focus on any individual sector. They are not limited to just the government. And in the face of those broad campaigns, we want to ensure that we have the resources to surge our support, our incident response, and our prevention activities to the scale that they're needed. And in particular, the kinds of entities that most often come to CISA for assistance, state and local governments, small private sector companies that don't have the resources and organic skills to be able to respond to incidents of the scale and severity that we have seen, a cyber response and recovery fund will be essential in ensuring that we have those resources, we can expand our capacity, and we can support our ability to get ahead of catastrophic cyber incidents. So we are eager to continue working with Congress on the establishment and execution of such a fund.
That from Brandon Wales. He is with the Department of Homeland Security. His testimony before a Senate subcommittee. And if you're interested, the full hearing, as with all of our programming, available at cspan.org. In other news, the Washington Post today naming associate editor for the AP as Sally Busby as its new executive editor, making her the first woman in the paper's 144-year history to lead the newsroom. She succeeds Marty Baron, who retired earlier this spring. This, by the way, the same position once held by Ben Bradley when the Washington Post helped break the Watergate story in the 1970s. Sally Busby has been with the AP since 1988, a number of roles, including as the D.C. bureau chief and now as the executive editor. She will take over as the head of the Washington Post newsroom on June 1st. And in London today, Queen Elizabeth II opening Britain's Parliament, sitting alone and foregoing her crown and formal robes, marking her first official ceremony since the death of her husband, Prince Philip. The annual Queen's speech is when she reads the government's legislative priorities at a ceremonial start of the new parliamentary session. Now, since taking over the throne, her husband of 73 years would traditionally sit by her side. Here is a portion of her remarks inside the House of Commons.
My government's priority is to deliver a national recovery from the pandemic that makes the United Kingdom stronger, healthier, and more prosperous than before. To achieve this, my government will level up opportunities across all parts of the United Kingdom, supporting jobs, businesses, and economic growth, and addressing the impact of the pandemic on public services. My government will protect the health of the nation, continuing the vaccination program and providing additional funding to support the NHS. My ministers will bring forward legislation to empower the NHS to innovate and embrace technology. Patients will receive more tailored and preventative care closer to home. Measures will be brought forward to support the health and well-being of the nation, including to tackle obesity and improve mental health. Proposals on social care reform will be brought forward. My government will build on the success of the vaccination program to lead the world in life sciences, pioneering new treatments against diseases like cancer, and securing jobs and investment across the country. My ministers will oversee the fastest ever increase in public funding for research and development, and pass legislation to establish an advanced research agency.
From London earlier today with Queen Elizabeth as the new parliamentary session got underway. A reminder, this program is a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.